I'll call the pre-council meeting of the Columbia City Council to order, quorum being present. We do have a lot of material to get through today, and then we're going to have to also make a motion to go into closed session for collective bargaining discussions and sealed bids and related documents prior to a contract being executed. First order of business, we've had a request from Council Member Ian Thomas to participate remotely tonight, and while we did that once as a council during the stay-at-home order, we don't really have a policy on that, and I wanted to at least bring it up for council discussion to see kind of how we wanted to handle that. Some people regard that differently, but what are your all's thoughts?
I'll start.
Mr. Trapp, thank you.
There's very little difference between now and when we had the remote meetings. I think there were multiple ones early, so I think we've established the precedent. The emergency order still stands, which I think is our authorization for deviating from our long-held practice of having people physically present. I wasn't involved in those discussions that allowed that to happen, but I was one of the four members present physically to have a quorum. There was a lot of unknowns, and it seemed very appropriate. It's been going on a long time, and it seems like it's not an emergency, but it's an emergency. There's a lot of COVID out, in addition to Ian being exposed from losing his mom to COVID and dealing with that with his family, which is a tragedy. Mr. Pitzer is under quarantine. And so I think by not allowing Mr. Pitzer, Mr. Thomas to participate, it undermines the legitimacy of the process that we're going here. There's risks involved. I thought what you sent out for background information were some important questions, but it doesn't weigh the risk of the legitimacy of the process and just the common sense test and the establishment of what's your recent precedent. So those are thoughts on the matter. I'm a definite yes.
Anybody else? Mr. Scala.
Yeah, I really am torn on this issue. I know we discussed it before. We do have precedent because we did do some of this under an emergency declaration. That was soon after the emergency declaration was established. I mean, there are obviously pluses and minuses in a situation like this. I mean, there are national precedents that there are representatives and senators that need to be gurneyed in to vote in person. There is no such provision, and although I appreciated the opportunity to participate in some of those meetings, I always felt that they were a little empty. That is, that you really couldn't read the rest of the folks, you couldn't really participate with the public, and so on. There were some limitations when it came to that. I'm really torn about this. The bottom line here, from my perspective, is to first ask legal, is this legal? Does this conflict with state statute? Whether or not we did it before, did we do it properly? And is this acceptable to proceed this way?
Yes, Missouri law does contemplate allowing elected governmental bodies to meet via video conference. When there's a majority in the room or quorum in the room in particular, if there's less than a quorum in the room, you are required to state what the emergency is for less than a quorum in the room. So quorum in the room, it is authorized under the Sunshine Law. We have, we call it a see and be seen requirement. We think our see and be seen is meets the minimum requirements of the Sunshine Law. We think we can do it better. On your agenda tonight, there is an item to purchase some additional equipment so that we can enhance just exactly what you're talking about, that ability for you to be able to see the faces, not only see their faces, but for them to actually see your faces better. So we think we can do it better, but yes, I believe this complies with the Sunshine Law.
Well, that's reassuring that we weren't violating the law when we did this before, because everything was kind of in an emergency situation. We are still under that emergency doctrine. I suspect that if we decide to go ahead with this, we stipulate that it ought to be within the context of an emergency declaration. We do need to have a thorough discussion as to what the policies are to move forward, so that we can make sure that everybody understands what that is. And this is not just an ad hoc decision made because of, for whatever reason. So that's my comment on this.
Let me continue your inquiry of the city attorney. If we allow a member of council to participate remotely, I've already received a request from a member of the public to participate remotely and submit testimony virtually. Are we required to do that?
There is a difference between the public and the elected representatives. You are the elected body for the city. Members of the public are allowed to speak on any item based upon our charter. And it's also based upon the rules that you establish for public participation at meetings. It's not required under the Sunshine Law that members of the public be allowed to attend or speak virtually. There are other opportunities for members of the public to provide input to council, which is really what the role of the public is to provide input to you as and their thoughts and their guidance. And they have ample opportunities to do that through other means, whether that is in writing, via telephone call. Submission, as you know, to the clerk is one of the ways that we establish that during the pandemic emergency. So
if the council adopts this as our practice, are we also obligated for consistency or liability to allow it for other boards and commissions underneath that are a creature of the city council? Planning and zoning, board of adjustment, CPRB, what about disabilities commission, other commissions?
Sure. It is currently, that is the practice that we've been implementing for other boards and commissions. Council did establish a quorum in the room requirement, and so we've been holding tight to that requirement, which is that is as long as there's a quorum in the room, the meeting is deemed to be at that location. So for instance, this evening, if you have members that are participating via video conference, your meeting is being held here. This is where the public would come and provide their input. This is where we get the public broadcast, so to speak, from. So that is the rule that we've been operating under. And we've had various members participate via video conference from time to time.
Would you recommend that we formally adopt those rules?
Yes.
And with respect to your suggestion as to continuing this during an emergency, and I want to hear from Dr. Peters and Councilmember Fowler, I mean, I don't know that it should ever be for the sole convenience of the member, that it ought to be emergency driven, whether as a result of our emergency order or something else, but I do think it should be rare. My preference is that we all meet and are accessible to the public as part of that participatory democracy we have. Comments? Dr. Peters?
Well, I agree with Carl and Mike that we should go ahead and allow, as long as we've got a quorum in the room, that we could allow video conferencing while people are in quarantine. And while this emergency, you know, while we still have this emergency declaration thing going on, and when we, you know, still have COVID rampantly running through our city, whether we need to do it once this is over, I don't know. So I guess we'll have to see how this works and get input from everyone regarding that. I am happy to hear that we do meet the sunshine requirements without having to have virtual comments.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm told by other people who have messaged me about this that other communities across the country are introducing regular public participation via video conferencing. I've not had a chance to study that specifically, but I am aware that our Disabilities Commission is talking about access to our meetings as a disabilities issue, a disability rights issue. And I received a letter today, I assume you did as well, from a member of that commission expressing her concerns about that. As far as tonight goes and as far as COVID goes, I would like us to adopt a policy that when a member of this body or a member of a board or commission is quarantining or isolating per our recommendations of our health department, that we not leave them out of the decision-making process as long as we have a quorum in the room. So I'm in agreement that Mr. Pitzer and Mr. Thomas can join us this evening.
Can I just comment on your comment?
There
are boards and commissions, and then there are boards and commissions. And obviously, some of them have kind of independent authority, if you will. Certainly, that's true with the Planning and Zoning Commission, the Board of Adjustment, and maybe a couple of others. We recently ran into some difficulty when I was not able to attend a meeting, the Broadband Planning Task Force, not that I'm a voting member, I'm co-chair, but I'm not a voting member, so it really didn't matter in terms of the quorum and so on and so forth. But there was supposed to be an audio link, and it didn't really work, and it was problematic and so on. All I'm saying is there are some staff limitations to the extent that we can make available this kind of deluxe model that we have we're privileged with in the City Council, that they can provide us additional resources and make this even a better product. I'm thinking it certainly has to be tied to the emergency declaration, I think, in terms of trying to avoid other additional difficulties. But I also think that we have to limit it. I'm not trying to get rid of anybody's opinion, but when it comes to all the boards and commissions, and we have 63 or 4 of them or however many we have, it's almost beyond the staff's capacity to keep up with all of this, to make sure that everybody is included in this kind of policy decision. So my preference would be to consider this certainly for the City Council and those other boards and commissions that fall in that rubric of independent authority. Tie this to an emergency declaration and allow the staff to develop the means necessary to make this a better product and leave it at that. That's just my perspective.
May I ask a question of the mayor? Are we discussing the circumstances of tonight, or are we looking to give staff guidance on a policy for the future? Because I think those are two separate conversations.
They are, and what I was going to suggest is that now that there's consensus among council that our two not physically present members be sent those coordinates, we get that out to them as soon as we can. But then as long as we are, it seems like we would all agree that there's, while we're under this emergency order, that we should, I like your suggestion, and I think that dovetails with Mr. Scala, that maybe we ask the city manager, using his emergency authority, to have a 3-month policy or whatever it is, at least for council members. But I do think we need to have some type of process to make sure that it is rare and infrequent, and that we don't abuse it while still protecting access and transparency.
I think if we're going to put through a policy, it might be something that the public will want to be heard on. Of course, many members of the public are measuring or protecting themselves and their families by not appearing in person. So I'm open to having a more robust resolution and or policy on that. I just don't want us to make a decision about that tonight when we're trying to just
open
this meeting.
I'm not inclined to do that.
Thank
just
you.
Given our,
sure.
I think it requires more thought.
Yes, it does.
Than even in thank you for taking the time to read the paper, although it was written in 2013, you know, I was inclined not to like it, but I didn't know why I didn't like the practice. And I think asking myself those questions, you know, do we open this up for virtual public comment from just our constituents? How about people from St. Louis? How about the state of California? I mean, at what point are we disenfranchising our own constituents because we're so accessible by everyone that may have a stake in our discussion?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, Madam Clerk.
You want me to go ahead and send the links to those two members now?
Is there any
or
objection?
We're still discussing. And this is for all of our meetings tonight to include the continuation.
Well, that brings up a good point. I mean, at some point we're going to be in closed session. And one of the factors from the academic paper I sent you is remote voting, not that we vote in closed session, is remote participation appropriate in a closed session where legal and confidential items are being discussed?
I was under the impression we didn't have the capacity for remote access when we moved to the other room anyway, and that sort of forecloses the question.
Jeff says we are prepared for a closed session.
Oh, we could do it in closed session. Okay.
In the other room.
So is that for both meetings?
We have the capacity and it's secure.
Secure on our end?
Well, yeah.
That's the problem.
Right. No, I understand.
Yep. I believe your answer is yes, Madam Clerk.
Okay, I'm going to send them for all three. The continuation of this, closed, and the regular. Right.
Thank you.
Now. Thank
all right.
You.
And thanks for the thoughtful preparation discussion. Moving on. City Manager, you are responsible for all collective bargaining. Anything you want to introduce to us at this point?
Yes. So tonight's pre-council is dedicated to labor group presentations. And our first presentation is Fraternal Order of Police, Columbia Police Officers Association Lodge, number 26.
Good evening. And let me see.
Dale, if you'll go to the right to forward.
Nope.
Right. All right. Point at me and I'll click for you. Oh, there we go.
Oh, it is doing something. Hello. Okay, sorry about that. So my name is Dale Roberts. I'm the executive director of the Columbia Police Officers Association. I'm going to try and just move right through this pretty quickly so as not to take, cut that out, so as not to take a lot of time and also to save time at the end for any Q&A that you desire. There are some officers here off camera, but they're my subject matter experts and can help us as needed. And I looked around the room when I first got here. I think, I don't normally like to bring this up, I think I may be the oldest person in the room. I'm certainly old enough to remember Dr. Martin Luther King, not as a history lesson, but as current events, which for me, you know, going all through high school, was an interesting experience, not only in, you know, equal justice for on racial issues, but on labor issues and many others. And with the holiday yesterday, this issue came to mind, the fact that when he was in Memphis, he was there to work on labor issues. That's why he was there. Just struck me as an interesting fact. As I said, it's maybe one of the few times I'm happy to be as old as I am to have experienced that. Labor issues for us is really narrowed down to one single issue. And the issue really revolves around pay compression with the police department, with the officers at the police department. And I'll tell you, I spoke earlier today for the first time speaking with a mask. It's an unusual experience. Anyway, pay compression, I sent a handout in advance. And basically the situation arises because in order to remain competitive, the city has had to increase starting pay for new officers in order to attract good people and be able to do recruiting. However, the city has not increased pay for existing officers proportionately. So as a result, brand new officer right out of the academy, never worked the street, starts at $22.29 an hour. An officer with 9 years experience, almost 5 years experience with CPD, and currently assigned as a detective makes, and I was gonna call on the officer, but I don't wanna do that to him. And that's not gonna change now. Next slide, but. Oh. Okay. So a brand new officer, fresh out of the academy, makes $22.29. An experienced officer, 9 years on the job, he's in the room, 5 years with CPD, almost. Currently a detective with VNOC, which is Vice Narcotics and Organized Crime, makes $22.34. In other words, 5 cents an hour more than an officer who's never set foot on the street and, in fact, hasn't even completed field training. This is why Columbia is losing officers. CPD has lost, by our count, 37 officers in the last 4 years, or the equivalent of about 20% of the entire department. That's not including those who have retired. And because of the turnover, 45% of CPD's current patrol officers have less than 2 years of experience. And in fact, 26% of them aren't even off probation yet. They're good officers, they had good training, but they certainly don't have experience on the street. We know pay compression hurts morale. How does it hurt the city? With the loss of those 37 officers, the cost of pay for the officers to pay and benefits to train them, step up pay for the field training officers during their training, combined, those experiences just to get a new officer on this street to replace one who has left has cost the city, as you can see, over $1 million. So basically, the city has lost, you could say wasted, over $1 million just to train new officers, get them qualified so they can work elsewhere for better pay. How else does this hurt the city? The continuing loss of experience and these permanent vacancies that the department suffers with have given Columbia the following results. As you can see from the first chart, calls per officer in the benchmark cities, and I'll give you a reference for those. Columbia is one of the top cities for the number of calls per officer. Our officers are busy all the time. And as a result, our response time is one of the worst. We have one of the slowest or one of the longest response times among all the benchmark cities. Average time for our officers to clear a crime, our crime rate clearance percentage is, as you can see, at the lowest end of the chart. Average time to solve an aggravated assault case, clearance rate is down towards the low end of the chart. Average time to solve a burglary case, closer to the middle, but still on the low end. Average time to solve a domestic violence case, way down at the bottom. Average time to solve a homicide, well at the bottom. Average time to solve a property crime, towards the bottom of the scale. Average time to solve a rape case, almost at the very bottom. Average time to solve any other sex offender case, excluding rape, almost at the very bottom. So the officers just can't keep up with the workload they have. You've seen the proof, and I'll give you the source for that documentation. The constant turnover, the constant process of training new officers, the continued loss of experience has taken its toll, and the residents suffer along with the officers. So what's the solution we propose? The city started the corrective process, albeit a one-time effort, last year. It was agreed to in 2019, in effect for fiscal year 2020. So we're simply asking the city to continue its corrective actions on a permanent basis. In other words, we're asking the city, please don't keep kicking this can down the road. It'll help the officers, it'll help retention, it'll help the department in recruiting and attention, and it'll enable the city to budget for the future. And I hope I'm not misquoting you, Councilman, but I believe in the past, Councilman Trapp has said, you know, a step plan or some kind of a plan would help us to budget for the future. So the city's plan, which we have used, which the city offered, we accepted, and was used for fiscal year 2020, is what you see before you. It said, okay, an officer with 3 years time and grade gets moved a certain amount, 4 years, 5 years, and so on. And that starts to address this problem of pay compression. And we agreed, ordinarily under our contract scenario, wages would have been settled last summer and would have kicked into effect at the end of September to start October 1st. We agreed to wait because of COVID. But we still believe whatever happens should take effect when they would have taken effect in October of 2020. One new component we're asking for is that in the past, officers have moved to the midpoint, halfway up, you know, up the pay scale. It's supposed to be there by 5 years. Beyond that, officers the city has not really done much. There have been few, if any, raises after the five-year midpoint. And in fact, the city's HR's position, not under the current director, has been no one reaches the top of the range. That's not even an option. And so we've asked, well, why is there a range that goes up to a certain dollar if no one is ever allowed to reach it? So we have a proposal that would also address the senior officers to resolve that pay compression. So as I alluded to earlier, we don't have a senior officer making 5 cents or 25 cents an hour more than someone who's never been on the street. So our conclusion is, you know, CPOA readily agreed to delay negotiations over pay until the end of both fiscal year 2020 and calendar year 2020, so that any fiscal impact or financial impact of COVID can be seen and examined by all of us. Nevertheless, we don't think it's equitable to penalize the officers by saying, you know, you agreed to wait, so whatever pay raise we do, you're not going to get until sometime later this year. And, you know, we believe that, you know, when these pay problems are resolved, all other remaining issues in our collective bargaining process are going to quickly fall into place. The pay issue for years has been a substantial issue. The pay compression has been a substantial issue. We've enjoyed working with the city. We're certainly ready and willing to continue in that effort to find a solution to this challenge. I think it'll help. Obviously, it helps the officers, and morale will reduce turnover, help the department to recruit and reward and retain its officers. And with that, I will stop. I do have a printed out copy of everything, of the PowerPoint presentation for you, along with a couple other pages and one page that shows the source of the benchmark data that I presented to you in all those charts. It's a benchmark group that operates out of Overland Park, Kansas. Chief Jones, Columbia has long been a member of those benchmark cities. I know the city of Columbia, I know the city of Columbia has a group of cities that they look to as comparable cities for pay reasons. You know, college towns in Kansas and different places. The problem is we're losing officers to St. Louis. St. Louis is not included in the group of comparable cities, I don't think, but that's where St. Louis and Kansas City both are hiring away Columbia's officers, paying them more money. And as you saw from the charts I presented, it hurts our department, and I think it hurts the citizens. So I'll answer anything I can, and if I can't, there are several officers who know their job better than I.
Thank you. Are we currently in year one of a three-year agreement?
We just, yes. Yes.
Is that right? And so then you have a wage reopener that you can do. So only on financial issues or only on non-financial issues?
Actually, we're not even, of course, it's a matter of terms. This isn't really even a wage reopener. It was just when we did our three-year contract last year, the city asked us to wait. We should have done pay as a part of our three-year contract, and that would have been in front of you last September. And the city asked us, you know, said, we'd like to wait. We don't know what's happening with to finances with COVID. We'd just like to cut that piece out and wait and do it in January or February. And we said, sure, let's all wait and see. So it's a wage reopener. It's not a wage reopener. I mean, we're simply
got it
back to do that component.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Roberts? Council Member Fowler.
Thank you, Mayor. Going back 10 years when I was a neighborhood association president, we had an officer that attended our meetings. I remember him telling me that after he was done working his full-time job for the city, he worked almost full-time for a apartment complex as their security person. And the concern I had that day is still the concern I have now, which is how are officers rested and ready to work their full-time job for the city when they have so many additional hours? So I read your labor contract very carefully, and I also read the labor contract for the fire department and for the union workers in 955, because I'm concerned about all of these professions, which are dangerous, which according to conversations that we've had with city staff in the past, have serious workers' comp issues at times. So I remain concerned, and I talked to the city manager today about looking more deeply into the amount of money that our officers earn, first of all, as their base pay, then earn in overtime that the city pays for them, and then also because there's an administrative tracking system for extra duty pay that I'm very concerned and interested in those hours. And so I just want you to know what my inquiry is going to be, and that I have asked the city manager to provide us with that information, and I'll do the same with the fire department, although I don't think there's a secondary market for being a firefighter after hours, but there appears to be a very expansive secondary market for being a police officer after hours. And so I don't know how to reconcile that with the zipper clause that's in your wage agreement, because it talks about anything within the four corners of the document are not open for discussion again until we reach the next negotiation period at the end of 3 years. So those are things. I don't know how much additional conversation we have planned among council on these issues, but there are certain information that I think we will be looking for to have that conversation.
And I appreciate that. I maybe sounds silly. I worry about what I consider my officers, and I'm in touch with them. I know with a lot of them how much time they are putting in both with the department, and some of them they're off-duty work, and there are two forms of they can work off-duty in uniform mm-hmm. where they have police powers, or they can work off-duty painting houses or mm-hmm. mowing yards. And, you know, I'm friends with some of them, and a couple weeks ago, a really dear friend who lives just a few blocks away was saying, you know, my husband's working Christmas, the kids are really upset, they haven't had Christmas with him for years. So I share your concern. And it's kind of that vicious cycle that we've lost officers who have gone to work for Dollar General. They can make more as a manager at Dollar General. They can make more money as a manager at Quick Trip. They can make more money as a loss prevention department supervisor at Walmart or Target. They, in order to be a policeman, and many of them are called to the profession, they find it necessary to work off duty to make enough money to live the way they feel they should. And obviously, if they could make more money as a police officer, we'd hope they could reduce the off-duty work. You see what I'm saying?
I understand
the
cycle.
And obviously, it's a vicious cycle of, you know, how to cut one and increase the other and so on.
But our preeminent concern, given the state of policing in Columbia and the tension that we have between our citizens and our police officers, and sir, you are part of the reason we have that tension with our citizens, is if you put an officer who is not well rested, who is unable to make good decisions because they're exhausted or tired or have all these other pressures, how is that improving the relationship between our citizens and our police? And that's part of the discussion.
Sure.
So I think we have more to talk about. Pay compression, when I've sat out in the audience for the last 16 years, has been a topic for every city employee. And I understand how hard our officers work. I understand how hard our firefighters work. I understand how hard our trash collectors work. But we have a job to address pay compression for all of our staff.
Certainly.
And not just our police officers.
Right.
Any additional inquiry? Mr. Scala. And then we do have two more of these.
Yeah,
I want
yeah,
to try
I
to get through and be
briefly,
sensitive to
yeah.
fairness.
Well, thank you for your presentation. I appreciate it. And these are substantive issues. I hope we take them up in closed session and discuss them more. I was curious, though, on a kind of a lighter note, you mentioned that you think you're the oldest person in the room. I was curious as to what year you were born. You don't have to answer that if you don't want to.
Well, I graduated high school in 1970.
I graduated high school in 1964.
Okay, you got me.
1946 was the year of my birth.
Fair enough.
Thank you.
Any additional inquiries? Seeing none.
Sir, I'm sorry, I forgot to ask another question.
Before you do that, does anyone want to speak before I recognize her a second time? Seeing none, Madam Fowler.
I have had correspondence from community members asking when it is a good time to include a social media policy in the police contract. And I don't know that, because this isn't really a wage opener, but I just wanted to, because I've been on the receiving end of correspondence on that, I want to bring that up. And also whether or not it's appropriate to put some language into a contract about our efforts to move towards community policing, to move towards a guardian model of policing versus a warrior model. And I pose that question to our law department and to our city manager.
Well, I'll speak. We are working on a social media policy. It is, I believe, in either HR or legal, one of the two places right now. So we're trying to bring that forward. But as far as the contract, it would have to be negotiated with all the unions at that time.
And may I follow up on that?
Sure.
On the part about community policing, and we have actively supported community policing, and you know, some of the, again, older officers will say, well, that's what we do. We've always been involved with the community. Some obviously to a greater or lesser extent. I was at a speaking engagement some years ago with an officer who said, you know, I used to keep my baseball glove in the car, and if I saw some kids, I'd stop and play. And at that event, he said, I never have time, you know, to stop and play ball anymore. That's just, the call stack, the number of calls waiting for a response, never goes away. We're usually at what they call status zero, and status zero, of course, means every officer's on the call. But the officers have talked to me about, you know, the turnover is one of the things that frustrates community policing, because one of the main components of community policing is having Officer Smith assigned to this neighborhood, and she should stay there as much as possible so the neighbors know her and feel comfortable with her, and they don't have an officer of the day or an officer of the week. And when officers leave every 2 or 3 years, that frustrates that. So, you know, absolutely, there's so many pieces to this puzzle.
Anything further? Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time. There's nothing for me to spray with.
Okay? I think we'll, yeah.
I'm going to follow up after Dale. My name is Matt Nichols. I'm the elected president. I represent more than 150 Columbia police officers. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yep.
Okay. So I represent more than 150 Columbia police officers at this time. And just to follow up on some of the comments that we had prior to and going forward is, we have, as the Columbia Police Officers Association and the officers that we represent, we have embraced Chief Jones' model for community policing. We're on board. We are absolutely dedicated to moving forward as a department, moving forward as a city, everything that is in the best effort for our citizens. You know, almost all of our officers either live in the city or live very close to it. Many of us are, you know, born and raised. I'm a Columbia native, almost 40 years. So I have a vested interest in Columbia and making sure that we're all successful. You know, the one thing that we talk about, you know, when we talked about the pay compression and we talked about, you know, the turnover rates, one thing I want you guys to think about is right now with the 152 officers and sergeants that we have on our roster, approximately 48% of them have 5 or less years experience with the Columbia Police Department. 48%, almost half, okay? Of that remaining, approximately 98 of those officers are not assigned to a specialty role. They're assigned to patrol. 26 of the officers that we have in patrol cars up and down the street responding to calls, 26 of them have more than 5 years experience at the Columbia Police Department. 73% of our patrol cops are less than 5 year cops that we have serving our citizens every day. Now I can say from the depths of my heart, we have absolutely amazing officers. Some of the best in the country. I truly believe it because I know it, because I've seen it, okay? If we want to continue hiring, recruiting the best and the brightest for our officers, for our citizens, We have to fix these issues, okay? And I won't elaborate further on Dale's presentation, but I can tell you folks is we are at a critical point. We're at a critical point because we look to the staffing that we have now, and again, phenomenal cops. We have great officers that are embracing the community policing model, that are doing the right things for the right reasons because they're committed to us, right? We need to be committed to them, okay? And one of the scariest things that I see is we take a look at the next 5 years, and we pulled some numbers. In the next 5 years, we have approximately 32 officers that'll be eligible. And that's of our 152. That's not accounting for command staff. 32 of them will be eligible for pension, okay?
In how long?
In the next 5 years, approximately 5 years. So in the next 5 years, we may have another 32 openings where they need to go to a detective role, where they need to go to a supervisor role, where you know they may move into a command staff level position. I want everyone to just please be aware that we have to stop the revolving door. We have to stop this endless cycle of having an officer come in. We spend the money to train them. We spend the great time and resources of the amazing staff that we have at CPD for them to go somewhere else. For them to say, you know what, I'm just not going to work these long hours for what it is, and they go to a private business. They move into another a career field. So I just want to say thank you for giving us the opportunity to present. Like I said, we are absolutely dedicated. We're on board. We are. And we want to work together as much as we can to make sure that we embrace all of the community values, the community policing elements that Chief Jones has put together, and do the right things for the right reasons and really build a community that everybody is proud of and that everybody wants to be a part of. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Detective.
International Association of Firefighters, Local 1055.
All right, well, it's taking a second to line up. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Zach Rivette. I was elected in December, served as president of our labor group. I served as secretary treasurer for 3 years prior to that, alongside Travis Gregory, and me and Travis still talk, and I'm proud to be following in his footsteps. You've probably heard from me before. I'm sorry, Ms. Fowler, you have not. I look forward to working with you as well. I'm not going to go into super great detail. I'm going to piggyback right off of Dale. He did a great job, I think, of explaining some of the same issues. As Ms. Fowler pointed out, that all employees are dealing with the same pay and compression issues. So I'm not going to, you know, beat you guys up with that. So this is going to be pretty short. And a lot of what we see the details of will happen in the collective bargaining room with the city's team. I know you guys give them the directive. So what we're asking from you guys is to give them the directive for commitment. Dale was just speaking to commitment to compensation year over year, annual raises, so that we can continue to move people along and keep them here and working for us. So that's what, and the we'll talk about in the conversation. Staffing, obviously it's been an ongoing conversation that we've had with you guys. We would like to see a minimum of 4-person staffing on our trucks. One of the things that we have moved from is looking for a plan to increase that staffing over some time. We don't have to do that all right now, but we want to see a plan in place to do that. We have 2 holidays that are paid at 11.25 hours instead of 24. We all work 24 hours or 48 hour shifts now, but 24 hours at a time. And then some plans to increase our training budget. And I've spent a lot of time with the fire chief since I got elected, and I think we're both on the same page. I'm really looking forward to working with him. And so I think he would back me up on a lot of the things we're going to talk about. We're going to submit a proposal to ask for annual pay raises, things that continue to move off or firefighters, I want to say officers, we're not officers, we're firefighters, move them down the pay scale. People want to know that they're going to be rewarded for doing their job, committing to the city for long term, and so we're going to look at that. We got to continue to address compression. We can't put that off. We saw that, and I'm glad that John took that initiative to start that process. COVID got in the way this last year, so we're looking forward to continuing that process as we move on. And then specifically, we have a grade, our engineers right in the middle, and they kind of got left out in the previous raises that we've seen. And so we want to make sure that we take care of them this cycle for sure. And again, we just want to see that commitment from the city long term. What we would like to see is through the duration of the contract rather than year over year. And in order for this to happen, we have to have our pay and compensation as the top priority in the budget process, not what's left over when the budget process is over. So we would like to see that conversation. When it comes to staffing, we're going to look to get proposed. I'm sorry that's all there, but four-person staffing on all apparatus in service. I think we've, and again, I don't have all of the details here. I've showed you guys in the past that we're way more efficient on the fire scene when we have four people, even more efficient if we have five, but four is a good number across the United States. So, and again, we want to develop that plan so we don't have to pay for it all today, and we don't want to do that. I mean, if we could, it'd be great. But some sort of plan that deals with that over time. We are in the process of building two new fire stations. One's getting ready to start construction rather quickly. We're still working on some land on the other. And there's no plan to increase staffing with those new additions. It's to move staffing around. So we're just going to spread the fire personnel thinner than they are right now. Again, the two holidays, they're paid at 11.25 hours. We want to see them moved up to 24 hours. And then our professional development. We just want to see our training budget increased. They took substantial cuts during the economic downturn back in 2008. That's kind of where we gave up our resources. And in order to continue to allow our members opportunities to train and get better, we got to start bringing that back up. So we would like to see a plan to increase that. Also, I just would like to point out that because of our shift, we can't do a lot of the on the city's sponsored training. Because we can't attend in the normal 5-day work week. And so that's a little bit difficult for us. So with that, we know that all this involves money, and we know that money's tight all the time. So we're willing to work with the city to develop these plans and have a good plan, and we'll move forward into the future. I think I've spoke with John and with our fire chief as well, Mr. Glasshawk, sorry. And we're committed to making this work. We're committed to doing this the right way. And so as we move forward, I look forward to working with them to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Privet. Let me ask you a question on those holidays. So help me understand why two holidays are only compensated 11.25. And I have a theory that not all firefighters work all holidays. So they probably looked at, with the schedule you have,
right,
what is the frequency that you will be expected to work on a holiday and be compensated for that?
I believe it was it started under former city manager and to balance our...
So there really is no reason for that.
Well, there's that too. I think it was done to balance, you know, normal employees get 8 hours. That would be the equivalent of an 8-hour holiday for what normal employees
divided
get,
by...
regardless of whether we work 24-hour shifts or 8-hour days. So I think that was some sort of a balancing act that, I mean, we still work 24 hours, whether it's Christmas Day or a normal Friday. So
any other questions for Mr. Privet? Dr. Peters.
If I remember, I thought you all went to 48-hour shifts last year or whenever, and that was to allow you all more time off. And so when did you guys go back to 24-hour shifts?
We haven't. We're still working 48-hour shifts, and those 24 hours are the 24 hours that we work holidays. So, you know, if Christmas falls on a Friday, we're still on shift for all 24 hours of those days. We didn't change any of our holidays when we changed the to the 48 hours.
Oh, so the holidays you work 24 hours and everything else you work 48 hours?
Yes, ma'am.
And working 48-hour shifts means that you can't make it to the training, the city training?
Well, so like if our shift is Monday, Tuesday, this week, it's going to be Wednesday, Thursday that week. And if the city has training on Tuesdays for 5 weeks in a row, that we're not on shift 5 weeks in a row on Tuesdays.
Okay.
So that in order to complete those, you have to make all of those in person, and we're just not on shift those days.
All right. Thank you.
Councilman Fowler.
Can you help me understand how you're at a place where you work 48 hours on and then a certain number of days off, and how that pattern came to be? Because it seems to have a lot of disadvantages. You're telling us you can't come to city training. And then I have a follow-up question about the training budget. Right. So help me understand the 48-hour shift.
Right, so there's multiple shifts that firefighters work across the country, one being a 24 on, 48 off. Our old shift that we moved off of was 24 on, 24 off, 24 on, 24 off, 24 on, 4 days off. So there are a range of shifts that firefighters work. One, the idea being we're on duty 24 hours, it's some perspective. The 48-96 is kind of a new thing, started on the West Coast to kind of reduce travel time for employees that worked in big cities, and they could come in, work, and leave. And it also, you work your shifts and you get to go away for a while, as opposed to the 24, 24, 24, 24. So firefighter shifts are all weird when it comes to those things. Even if we worked at 24, 48, we're still not gonna be on shift the same days weekly, every week. So regardless of what that is, that's how our shifts have always been historically.
So I remember an interim update we had since I've joined council where the representative, I don't know if it was you, but someone said that 70% of your members have second jobs. So it comes back to my other concern about whether or not you are sufficiently rested and refreshed when you come to your primary job. And that's something I also want to take up in discussions with the city manager about that, because not only does it tie into the city's expenses for injury and other consequences, but it also leaves you vulnerable, because if you're running into a burning building scenario,
absolutely,
I want you to be well rested.
Sure.
So I do have that question and concern. And then I wanted to ask about, you said there was a cutback in training. Is that, do you all have to pay for your own training to be certified firefighters, or does the city?
So the city provides the minimum requirements.
Okay.
It would be ongoing type of stuff if we want to. It's a really kind of, the department provides the minimum training required every year to maintain our certificates and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
If we want to advance our career, if we want to step outside the box just a little bit, be a little better employee, then either we have to ask for time off, which is limited.
Mm-hmm.
The chief is doing an amazing job of trying to get us more opportunities to do that. Or we have to ask for the class to be paid for, which is also limited because of budget constraints. So a lot of us, and I'm one of them, I pay for my own training, my own travel, my own hotels and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
so that I get what I want out of it. And I think there's an opportunity for us to provide that opportunity for other members too. The fire service is a weird beast when it comes to training, because there's companies all across the country that put on good training, and it costs money to bring them here, or it costs money to go to them. So regardless, it's a financial issue.
And I understand that not everyone can bear that cost equitably, or has the ability to do that. But you're not unlike a lot of other professions where we all have to pay our own way into if we want an upward promotional path. So I have sympathy for your struggles, because I've been there myself. So thank you. And I wanted to ask, the two paid holidays that are only 11.25, are those, I looked at the list of holidays, there were 9 defined holidays, which I know move around on the schedule. And then there were the two floating ones. Are the 11.25 hours tied to the floating?
One of them's Martin Luther King Day, one of them's Black Friday, which were recently added days.
Is that the day after Thanksgiving?
Okay. Friday, the day after Thanksgiving.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's all right.
But yes, and they were recently added. I think the day after Thanksgiving was last year, correct? Or the year before, 2 or 3 years ago. So just the recently added ones. Mm-hmm. No, the floating holidays are separate.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Any additional inquiries? Seeing none. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, guys.
Of course. Thanks for your service. Thanks. We have one more?
Yes, we have Laborers International Union of North America, Local 995.
Come on up, Mr. Hutchinson. Let me point out, while Mr. Hutchinson's coming forward, the power of our partnership with, I think, all of the bargaining units, but especially with laborers after the trash changes. They split the cost of an advertising campaign to help recruit more refuse collectors. And I thought that was in both their interests and in ours, and I appreciate that.
Appreciate it. So my name is Andrew Hutchinson. I am the field representative for Local 955 workers. So we represent the solid waste workers, mechanics, basically service and maintenance workers throughout the city of Columbia, both this governmental body and other public institutions here. So just to give kind of a very quick, I know this looks like a lot, so we're going to handle some things that are within the contract and within Chapter 19. So we are in the wage opener part of collective bargaining negotiations. So it's going to be everything from longevity increases to also handling specific tool allowances. So I want to start with Chapter 19 stuff first. So to begin, talking about shift differentials and standby pay. So basically, our folks who work night shift, like for instance, right now, we have mechanics who are fixing everything from city buses to solid waste trucks at the Grissom building. So we're asking for an increase in that shift differential, and we're also asking for an increase in standby pay. So these numbers have not gone up significantly in a long time, so we're asking for them to go up in the rate of inflation. And the other bit that we're asking for is hazard pay for mechanics or other workers who are in hazardous conditions. And this requires a bit of explanation. Right now, the current policy is to ask if a, for instance, this happens on Route B a lot, if a truck is on the side of the road, they'll send a mechanic to sometimes try and get it up and running. The mechanics have come to me numerous times and said, this is terrifying work. To be alone, especially in low light conditions like on Route B, and that they would appreciate hazard pay. Same with folks who do work in hazardous winter weather conditions, just so we can be safer and also show these workers who we struggle with retention with that we respect their work. So the next one, these are allowance changes. So these are similarly to the stuff before. This is asking for increases in set allowances that are prescribed in Chapter 19, and I've listed where they're prescribed. And the other part of these three, so it's $50 to $100 for winter outerwear, $150 to $200 for protective footwear or boot allowance, and then finally the tool allowance. So before I get into the tool allowance, I want to say a big part of this proposal is asking for it to all come in one paycheck, and I think the timing of that paycheck is up for negotiation, up for collaboration. The reason it's good to be paid in full is you cannot put a winter coat on layaway. So when we hire a brand new person who's throwing trash on the back, if they don't have a good winter coat or good protective boots, if we are not giving them that money or that uniform up front, we're creating artificial barriers for gainful employment with the city. And the tool allowance is a big jump. So you'll remember some of our mechanics.
$300?
So currently they make $800 on the tool allowance. So you'll see that this seems like a massive jump of $1,000. But in our other contracts, specifically with Boone County Public Works, those mechanics received $1,750 as a tool allowance. And the county evaluated this and said, well, this is a lot of money. These folks are having to buy a lot of tools. So everyone that we hire for the mechanic position will use county-owned, maintained, and supplied tools after this point. So it's only three workers who still receive that grandfathered tool allowance. Our point being, it's clear that these mechanics have been essentially forking over their money, sometimes only 22 or 23 an hour, to buy tools to keep the city running. So the current status quo is depending on city wages subsidizing the trucks, whether it's our favorite issue of solid waste, or the fire trucks, or the police cruisers. Our vehicles are being subsidized by city workers' wages to purchase the tools. So the tool allowance is a very, very big issue and ties into the rest of the allowances. Continuing, this starts to get into our proposals that are around encouraging retention and longevity of employees. So we understand that the insurance market being what it is, Councilwoman Fowler, you had spoken about the $750 deductible health insurance plan. We know the city does not have full power to do whatever it is they can, but my membership was very passionate about trying to relook at that issue and see what we could do about it. I have another chart on the next page to talk about the vacation accrual, but before we get into that, this is actually a kind of a sad point, but funeral leave. So in all of our other city contracts in Columbia, specifically, or in Boone County, excuse me, specifically thinking about MU and Boone and the city of Centralia. So if a employee loses a family member, then they are entitled to 3 days off, not deducted from sick leave or vacation time to attend the funeral and to grieve. In the city contract, we do not have that. Funeral leave can be deducted from sick leave or vacation time. And usually that has not been a pressing concern, but unfortunately with quarantine time from COVID-19 and unfortunately a lot of our frontline workers losing a lot of family members to COVID-19, it's resulted in really showing the need for funeral leave. And frankly, so many of our workers operate heavy machinery that in terms of safety, it is really scary to think that someone could bury their wife or their mother one day and then be driving a city bus or a street sweeper the next. So I think this is good for safety, and it's good not just for our members, but potentially citywide as well. This is the vacation accrual chart I mentioned. I don't think we're necessarily sold on these numbers, but the new values are on the left. The crossed out ones are what we are at currently. This is to encourage longevity and retention because we are having a lot of loss. And that loss not only makes it harder for the city to run day to day, but every time we lose a mechanic, we're losing an incredible amount of knowledge. Now we're moving from Chapter 19 directly into our collective bargaining agreement proposals. So this language goes into the rights of union representation. So first off, in Section 7, right now the only way that I can visit a work site is to give one full business day of notice, and I have to make sure it's taking place during rest periods. This has resulted in, even when I would give correct notice, if that notice did not go to the supervisor who was on duty, I would be pretty frequently accosted, spoken to, or they would interfere while I was checking in with a worker. Comments from, you're not supposed to be here, to actually the only thing a union meeting is good for, you all should be teaching them how to be better workers. So this comes down to adding this language, not hindered nor harassed, is a good blanket statement that allows us to conduct site visits and work with employees and encourage retention without being harassed by supervisors. And the next two follow along with this, adding our right of orientation with new hires and the right for members to be informed by management to request a union representative or steward. Right now, it's possible that someone could be hired, work for the city, and maybe disciplined after 6 or 7 months and never have been informed of their union representation rights if I haven't or another steward has not found them yet. Going into wage proposals, this 11% across the board increase, we're flexible on this number, but right now our issues with retention, especially in solid waste, shows that our wage numbers are low. very low, and we need to not only create an across-the-board increase, but be serious about building a clarification of the five-year to midpoint language. Most folks, when they hit their 5 years, are told that there's not enough money to get them to the midpoint, which is why we've also asked for smaller raises to be built in, so it's covered up by the screen. But the union's proposing a 5% raise at 6 months, 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, and 4 year. And we are open to negotiation and collaboration during the wage proposal process, but what we need to do as a culture within the city is ensure that folks see a reason to stay past just getting their CDL from the city, because that's what we're having. One of the members that I built a relationship with, who actually spoke here at City Council last year, was a young gentleman, and I found out recently he was an active member of the union. He was loved his job, but then he found another job and from the solid waste, driving a truck, making significantly more money. And the issue is that when we get bright young folks who get those skills and we don't have clearly defined raises in the path moving forward, we're going to keep losing them, especially while our work continues to be so hard and dangerous. And that is everything. So basically, just a quick conclusion, we're focusing on longevity increases, some key allowance changes, and some collective bargaining adjustments. And I apologize if I'm sound breathy. This mask is a little hard to speak sometimes. Any questions?
Any questions for Mr. Hutchinson? Ms. Fowler.
I have a comment along some of the lines of what you're talking about. Now, when I used to work with students, we talked a lot about congruence. And in reading the labor agreements for each of these three organizations, there are differences, significant differences. And I don't know about the funding piece of it, but I need to wrap my brain around why we provide a uniform and equipment for a police officer. We provide a uniform and equipment for a firefighter, but we don't provide appropriate clothing, you can call it a uniform and tools for people that work in these particular jobs, mechanic, driver, and otherwise. I'm gonna spend some time talking about that, because I think that that's yet another reason why the jobs that you represent are perceived to be less desirable and harder to fill. And the other thing, when you talk about the tools and having tools ahead of time, if you're a young person who's come through any number of training programs that surround us, whether it's Moberly Area Community College or Lynn Technical or wherever it is that you're getting your training, but you don't have the resources to outfit yourself at the outset with those initial set of tools, you're hindered from seeking that employment. And I know collectively as a city, trying to find a way to help our citizens find an upward promotional path and to have that kind of economic stability and there's another word here I'm forgetting. But anyway, I appreciate what you've brought to our attention, and I have a lot to wrap my brain around as to why we have those differences, so thank you.
Yeah, there's one. Thank you for that. And there's one comment I neglected to mention, that these proposals were written by an elected bargaining committee that comes from our workers. So when we're looking at these requests for tool allowances, it's not something I wrote up in my office. This is something that the mechanics, solid waste, and city bus drivers sat down at a table, socially distanced, and worked all of this out.
Any further inquiry? Mr. Scala.
Yeah, of course, it would be to everybody's advantage if we could satisfy all of these needs. We obviously, we're always struggling for resources as well. Seems like that a lot of these requests fall into two categories. One of the categories is salaries and income on an ongoing basis, and that is an expense that we have to accommodate in terms of sales taxes and property tax and so on. And then there are one-time allowances, like tool allowances and some of the other kinds of things. Any comments about, I mean, I obviously just everyone wants to advance their own cause, but is there any kind of priority here? Well, what do you see as the major hurdles and the highest priorities for some of these issues?
I would prioritize. I think that's a good question. I think my immediate gut response, without going to the membership on it, would be that building in staggered raises of small amounts allow folks to not let inflation severely cut the amount of money that they take home. But at the same time, I have to say that the reason these allowances exist is because there is a cost of doing work to make the city work. And right now, where the allowances sit, we as a city, as a community, have said we are going to make our employees shoulder the cost to make this city work. And that's sad to me. But I think getting back into longevity and loyalty increases of a small amount is best for encouraging retention. But
yeah, just as a comment, it kind of reminds me of school teachers, for example, making some of the supplies available to their students. And I'm not saying that's not right either, nor is exactly what we're doing. But, I mean, it's the same kind of phenomenon. I think it needs to be addressed.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Any further inquiry? Seeing none. Thank you very much. Appreciate your presentation. Anything else while we're in public business?
No, sir.
I would make a motion that the City Council of the City of Columbia, Missouri immediately go into closed meeting in Conference Room 1A1B of the City Hall to discuss the preparation, including any discussions or work product on behalf of a public governmental body or its representatives for negotiations with the employee groups pursuant to Section 610.021, Subsection 9 of the Revised Statute of Missouri, and sealed bids and related documents until the bids are open and sealed, proposals and related documents or any but documents related to negotiated contract until a document is executed or all proposals are rejected pursuant to 610.021, Subsection 12 of the Revised Statute of Missouri. Is my motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Scala. Mr. Scala, how do you vote for closed session?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas? Mr. Thomas?
Yes.
Mr. Pitzer?
Yes. Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Mayor votes aye. Ms. Fowler?
Yes.
Mr. Trapp?
Yes.
We are in closed session. I would expect we come back to this room about 5 till.
Okay, we're going to the other room.
Going to the other room.